Interview with Robert Fleming, FLEMING, Washington, D.C., November 8th, 1979, Side 1.
Oh, cool.
Did you get those memos that I
did,
sent
yes,
you a copy
and
of?
I must confess that I'm not sure whether they're here on my desk or at home. I looked for them before yesterday and trying to do some more thinking and preparation. We had a great stack of stuff on our table at home, and my wife went through it, I read with interest some of my memos you had Xeroxed.
Well, I guess what I would like to ask you about is not the specifics of the memos, but just the existence of this. And I wondered if you could say something about these are daily summaries of the network television coverage during the period of TET 68. I wonder
if
you could say something.
Well, I think it's pertinent, though it sounds a little self-serving. Let me start with another question we raised of how I happened to go to work there. I was running the ABC Bureau here in Washington. And the practice was that whenever any president was going to do something on television, we rotated the turns. It was called the pool. And each network would take its turn at providing the manpower and the technical people. And when we later persuaded the LBJ to permit installation of videotaping equipment, television equipment, really, cameras, in the theater of the White House, we built at network expense, built the control room. The frequency of times he would do things increased, and one morning he had one that was just a simple thing of give to the American Red Cross. And it was to be fed to all three networks, which we fed out of the feeds from the White House. And it was set for 9:30 in the morning. And President and Jack Valenti came downstairs from the bedroom at about 9:10 and walked in and said they were ready to do it. Young producer we had assigned to the job had to say he wasn't ready. He had been ready at 9 o'clock with everybody, but when he said to all the other three networks, including his own, that everything was all set, somebody at NBC decided to go for coffee, and we lacked one man to push one button in the NBC shop. So the president said, "Well, then, if you're not ready, why don't I do it once and see how it goes?" And so he did. He read it off the teleprompter. When he finished, he said, "Well, that ought to be good. I can't do any better than that." To which Bill Wiesel said, "I'm sorry, Mr. President, nobody recorded that one." And so he said, "But we'll be ready very shortly." Meantime, he was frantically telling NBC, "Find your guy and get him back." And Valenti got impatient and went into the control room. He leaned over the microphone and said, "Whenever you're ready, Mr. President." Valenti didn't know, and nobody had told him, that ABC and CBS were ready and could go, and then later we could feed that to over our circuits to NBC, and they wouldn't have missed anything. But the president started to read it again, and Wiesel, the producer, said, "I'm sorry, Mr. President, NBC is not ready." And so in just a couple of moments, apparently, I never knew exactly how long, NBC was ready, and they went ahead, and the whole thing was packaged, was done before 9:30. But later in the morning, Valenti called me, and he said, "I understand it was your crew here this morning." And I said, "Yes." He said, "Don't ever send over people who are not equipped to do the job." And I said, "Well, I don't even know what you're talking about, Jack. I don't know what problem you had, but let me check and call you back." So I called in the producer, and Wiesel told me the story that I've recited. So I called Jack back and I said, "Jack, one thing you got to understand is you didn't belong in the control room. I don't go in a control room when a crew is doing this job. That's an engineering technical function. which I cannot contribute anything, you can't contribute anything, and you just created confusion. And we got argued a little bit more about it until finally I said, Jack, there's no point of discussing this any further. You don't have anybody over there who understands the problems of television. So no point in me explaining them to you or to anybody else on the staff. So about an hour later, Moyers called me and said, did you tell Valenti we didn't have anything about television? And I said, yes. So what else to tell him? I said, I'm not going to, as far as I'm going to go, because this was a personal argument the two of us had, and I've forgotten it already, and I hope Jack has. And this voice came on and said, I have. And I said, what's going on? And Bill said, well, I should have told you. I've got you on a speakerphone, and Valenti and Marvin Watson and I are here talking to you. And so we'd like your recommendations of who we ought to get. Well, I said, this will take me a little while. I'll call you back. So about an hour later, I called him and said, I got four names for you to consider. And I can send you over a memorandum detailing what the background of each one of them was. There happens one was Bill Small, who is now president of NBC News. One is Bill Monroe, you know, runs Meet the Press. They both were my opposite numbers of bureau chiefs at NBC and CBS. One was a young fellow who worked for me, and one was somebody else, I don't know. And Moyer's answer was, well, your name's not on the list. And I said, no. And he said, well, you didn't quite get the point. I thought you'd realize if Watson and Valenti and I called you together, we were calling it an instruction as the president, and you expected you'd say you were the man to take the job. I said, I'm not sure I am. He said, well, I'll get back to you. So he called a little bit after him and said, I need to have every place you worked and lived for the past 20 years. Well, I knew that was a security check. So I was fortunate in that I worked for Jim Haggerty. Haggerty had been Eisenhower's press secretary and had gone to ABC News as vice president for news and was the top man. So I called Jim and I said, what do I do? He said, you don't have any choice. The President of the United States tells you you're in charge of shoveling the snow off the front sidewalk every 4th of July. You don't tell him it doesn't snow on the 4th of July. You don't ask him where you get a snow shovel. You just tell your wife you won't be home any 4th of July. He said, not many people get asked to work for presidents. If you get asked, you don't have any choice. So I talked to my wife about it and told her that this thing was moving pretty rapidly. And then Moyers called up and said, will you see the president with me at 6 o'clock? And I said, yes. Went over at 6 o'clock, and I knew he hadn't gotten into the Oval Office till he said, send him in. And he was signing mail, and he didn't look up. And it seemed to me quite a while. It probably was a couple of minutes. So Moyers finally said, Mr. President, you and I have had some conversations today, and Bob and I have had some conversations. And I think it's, you thought it was time that you and he talked. Still didn't look up. He said, I don't know what there is to talk about. I know him, I like him, I trust him, I need him. And I said, Mr. President, as long as I live, I'll brag you said that, but let's talk about the fourth one. I don't think you need me. I said, why not? And he said, because I don't love you. At that point, the first time he looked up. He said, what do you mean by that? I said, well, Moyers here and Watson and Valenti, they would do anything for you, basically. But I'm an admirer of yours, and I think you're a good president, and I'm a supporter. But I got a wife and two kids that are more important to me than any job. And if I worked for you, I'd have to work around the clock, and I wouldn't see them, and I don't think I'm the one. So we talked about an hour about what I could do for him. What some of it he just said, well, if you're not going to work here, what should I learn from your being here? And we talked. So then I said I'd have to go talk to my wife first. By the time I got home, he had called her and asked her, which first time she ever talked to him. He called her, said, what don't you like about me? He said, I like you a lot. He said, well, I just tried to hire your husband and he doesn't, says he has to talk to you. What are you going to tell him? She said, I'm going to tell him you should have hired him 3 years ago. He said, well, I think you and I can get along just fine. So then he said, I'm going to go to Hawaii this weekend to meet with Westmoreland and Key and Two, who are then the number one and two men in the Vietnamese government. And I want you to go as part of the staff. And I said, Mr. President, I can go for ABC. I can arrange that with no problem at all. And when I go, I can do anything that I can be of help to you. But you can't you've got to have one thing, you've got to have a better security check than you've had before you take me, because Joe McCarthy used to say to me, wait till you see what I put in your FBI file. And I think I can deny anything that's damaging that's in that file. I don't know whether what's there. And you don't know what's there. And I can't risk embarrassing you by having you take me on and announce that I'm coming and you me start to work here and then find out the FBI's got something that I would have to explain away. So he said, well, you're coming along, go to Honolulu with us. And he called Marvin Watson and he said, how long does it take to get a thorough FBI check? And Marvin said, 5 days. He said, I want this one in 3 days. Well, there wasn't anything about me in the FBI file from McCarthy. He had just been his loose threats that he often used. But early on, I say early on, it wasn't very early, not immediately, but after a time. It was the president's intention, he said, that I would become the press secretary. But I didn't think that was much of a very good idea. He wanted to use Moyer's other ways. And I didn't think that was a very good idea, so I kind of backstopped Moyer's. And I would periodically, well, I had frequent access to the president because Moyer started gave me what we called the morning shift. Four of us would go to the president's bedroom at 7 o'clock in the morning. He had been awake for an hour already and had read a bunch of stuff, and he had a lot of questions, or none, and we'd be there really just to get directions of things he might have done. He oftentimes would ask, what do they mean when they say such and such? We were supposed to have read four morning newspapers before we got there. We split those up amongst us. And if none of us had an answer to his question, what do they mean when they say, I would immediately pick up and say, did you hear this on the radio this morning? He'd say, yes. Well, I learned very early that he didn't know what station he'd listen to or didn't listen. He'd switch from one channel to another. He had a push button. So he didn't even know where it was tuned to. But he was often critical of those who analyzed his motives in doing things. And he would resent they're doing it to the point of, why do they say that about me when they can't possibly know? But he wouldn't know who it was that said it. And it was just hell trying to find out who said it then. If somebody else in the office hadn't heard it, when they get back, lawyers, a couple other fellows in the office, and two or three other girls who listened morning broadcast for news, we wouldn't know. And oftentimes, I'd do nothing about it, and he'd forget he had asked, and so it wouldn't come up again. But also, after a reasonably short period, he had me start monitoring the evening news shows. And those memoranda that you saw were the daily product of those. Just, I couldn't tell you now, you probably may have seen going through the file no better than I. It seems to me it didn't last a very long time. Coincident with that, everybody on the staff was supposed to write memos on any conversations they had with reporters during the day. He was always very interested, very concerned in the media treatment of it. And one of the problems, really, of working for him was he needed 5 hours of sleep a night, and that was all. And he'd have a 45-minute nap in the afternoon. So he had more daylight, more working hours than most human beings. And late in the evening, I learned very early that everybody on the staff would gather in the then big West Wing lobby of the White House at about 5 minutes to 11 at night if we were still there. Because about 11 o'clock the phones had started to ring, he looked for people to eat with him. And those were most fascinating times, but there were 2-hour sessions from 11 to 1 a.m. and we were supposed to be back in the bedroom the next morning at 7. And also he had abysmal taste in food. One night I said to him, Mr. President, I'm not coming to eat with you anymore. I'm going to eat before I get here out of the sandwich machine. I'll eat downstairs in the basement. I'll eat better than I eat here. He said, what do you mean? I said, the last 4 nights, we've had hamburger patties, sliced green tomatoes, pinto beans, and tapioca pudding. And I said, I don't like any one of them. And he said, how do you mean the last 4 days we've had that? I said, we have. Don't you know what you've eaten? He said, no, I don't pay any attention to what I eat. To him, it was just fuel. and he didn't care. But in that period at night, he was always just reminiscent. He never would be argumentative. He never would seldom talk about current problems. He would go back in his memory to people and tell stories and love to recall. And he'd talk about reporters he had known long before I ever came to Washington. But he was, the memos you speak of, an awfully long answer for you, was that he was very sensitive to what impression he was making. He had a strong feeling that he was resented as a Texan. I used to argue that I'd covered politics a long time and never heard it raised as a complaint. And he said, that must be because you wouldn't notice it because you feel the same way. I said, no, I don't have any resentment against Texas any more than I have against a Georgian or a New Englander. Or but he did. He thought people did. And Moyer thought people had resented the Texans. Christians, something. Would argue. So all the Texans I've known have had that. He doesn't here, but he just, I work for a Texas congressman now, but he doesn't have the same exposure that they have. I talked too long.
No, what you told me was just fascinating, and that's fine with me. Whenever I run interviews, I give people a chance to answer questions however they feel. But I would, since I sent these memos and was interested in the subject, I just wondered if you can remember. I found television memos written by Peter Benchley and also by Lloyd Hackler. And I think you're right, this didn't last very long.
Yeah.
But it's during this especially critical period, just before he decides not to run for re-election in 68. And do you recall?
I think it was more period when he was deciding what to do about Vietnam, changing his views on Vietnam. He used to say, more often, the greatest lesson I learned from him, the thing he probably said more often than anything else, is repetition. We'd have a meeting and it would be over, and we'd be standing with him in his office to see what he wanted done next. He'd say almost to himself, it's not hard to do what's right. Anybody with guts can do what's right. Sometimes it's goddamn hard to know what's right to do. And I think, to a degree, not very strong, the television was the opposite view from what he was hearing. It was always my feeling that he believed in what he was doing, but he also could have done better at selecting the advisors that he listened to. Paul Rostow and General Taylor both had a long time feeling about Vietnam and never wavered in it, I don't think. I think that's why Rostow's response on your question, but he didn't have time to pay any attention to television. I don't think he did have time, but I also didn't think he wanted to hear the criticism that television was giving him. And he was, President Johnson lost touch, really. I don't know how much he had, for instance, with Cronkite. And I meant to know when you came, and I failed to know whether or not I'm not right that for a time he had made chancellor. He had appointed chancellor to something in USIA, Voice of America. I think he did. I think I remember the walking down the hall from the day. But the wagons just get put in a circle, and these outsiders weren't heard even. And the check marks on the transcripts of the memos about the thing indicated that currently probably that I would think that he may have been especially irritated at CBS. He thought they were picking on him. It was not unusual for him to think that somebody had it in for him. And it could have been an honest disagreement.
Do you have any remembrance of Johnson's, with his famous three TVs, watching the evening news himself? I wondered a bit about why the memos, given at least the visual evidence that he was watching a lot of television himself.
He would, if there was something he was interested in, and we knew it was going to make the evening news and would tell him so, he might try to. But he had, that thing was installed, I think as much as anything, by the White House communications agency to show they could do it. You know, they would give him a push-button desk control. He would occasionally turn on all three sets and then watch, and if something that he, the picture was something that either him or something event that he was interested in, he'd put the sound for that channel. It was a remote control thing in his hand. But he didn't watch daily. He'd watch it at 11 o'clock sometimes at the late news. But for a while, ABC had a network late news show. I don't remember whether either of the others did, but none of them lasted very long, survived very long for network programming, and local programming wouldn't be adequate to take his attention.
Well, I gather he must have watched some television in the morning. I think he kind of liked those morning shows where they would get
news. He would
news.
Keep, Dean Rusk one time said to me, I asked him why he went on to Today Show so often. He says, this is the one place I can talk to the president and 40 senators and have nobody talk back to me. And he'd have the Today Show on to see who the guests were. He'd only have to push the button for the sound if it was someone he knew and in the Washington scene and the government, maybe sometimes in the Senate.
You're giving me the kind of information that is especially valuable, because though I'm fascinated by television, I'm not the least bit keen on magnifying its a presence that doesn't exist.
Yeah.
Now, when I looked at the record of what Johnson was doing day after day, it didn't look to me as though he physically could have had time. So in a sense, what you're saying confirms a suspicion.
Yeah, most days he didn't.
What about, do you recall anything about this Walter Cronkite special on February 27, 1968. Johnson, George Christian told me that LBJ really did say what has been attributed to Christian in a couple of sources, that he watched this special where Cronkite had gone to Vietnam, came back and turned against the war, and LBJ said, well, if Cronkite's turning against me, I'm really losing Middle America. Now, do you recall anything of this sort? Okay.
He was a very troubled man for quite a while in that period, and withdrawn, so that we'd sit there in the morning and get a minimum of reaction from him, minimum during the day. Somebody had the duty all the time. Anytime he left the Oval Office, somebody of the three or four of us were with him, mainly as an errand boy. And oftentimes he could be delightful. My wife's favorite story about him is that he was going in one day to the East Room. He was going to present an award to somebody as Teacher of the Year. Some magazine sponsored it. And they came down out of the elevator. Mrs. Johnson was with him. And he stood in the elevator reading the 5x7 yellow card on which his remarks were typed. And he said, you know, they expect me to be witty for 5 minutes, and then in 2 minutes they want me to be serious about how important education is. And he said, Bird, what would you think if I dropped off the last two paragraphs? And he handed her the card, and she read it, and said, yes, I would. I think you're right. I'd leave them out. And he turned to me and said, what do you think, Bob? And handed me the card. While she was reading the card and he was watching her, I realized he was chewing gum. So I always carried a pad of paper in my pocket. I reached in and got a sheet of paper, and I had it in my hand. When he handed me the card to read the thing, he saw this piece of paper, and he took at it. And he said, what's this for? And I said, it's for your gum, sir. And he said, oh, all right. And Mrs. Johnson reached up and slapped me on the shoulder and said, bless you, Bob. If you had walked in there chewing gum, the headlines would have said, Lyndon Johnson chews gum in school, and then wouldn't have said anything about what he had to say. So he went in and did the thing, and then the routine called for, as two of them came out, I stood in the way and said, line. That meant you want a receiving line. If he liked the group and knew he had the time, he'd say yes, and this time he did. So I stepped out of the way and said to a Marine captain who was there, line. He stood up on his chair and said, ladies and gentlemen, President Ms. Johnson will receive in the blue room. If you'll form a line and follow me, I'll show you where to go. Meanwhile, I had turned to go catch up with him to see if he had anything else in his mind. Walked right into him. He was standing immediately behind me. He glared at me and said, where's my gun? He turned around and walked away. Well, that was a kind of a... He had that touch and could use it, and did it far more than he'd ever let us tell people. Later in the day, he said to me, if you print that gum story, you're out. And a number of times, human things he did, he would, because he said his reasoning was that he did them, he would be accused of doing them just to get favorable press. And it was not his purpose. He was just having a little fun, but he didn't want to make it look like he was posing as a congenial soul.
How about if you'd say something in a sense of what your a typical day might be, or something about your relationship with George Christian? So what you know, I don't.
When it was Christian, the situation was quite different, because when Christian replaced Moyers, he took over the Gunther bedroom, and I no longer did that. And so I would then thereafter handle things George wanted done, or the president never understood a staff structure. If he'd run into you in the hall, he might say, I needed such and such a paper. And I might have no idea what the paper was. And I'd go to Murray Famer, who was the best of his secretaries, and said, the president just asked me such and such a paper. Do you know what this is about? And she generally could say, yes, that's something he wanted from the State Department. And Dean Rusk sent it over, and it's on his desk. I'd go ahead and get it off his desk and carry it where he was. He'd say, fine thing. But I couldn't do it, because I wouldn't know what he meant. But Mrs. Johnson had explained that to me very early, that he didn't understand the staff function. So when I first went, I'd go to the bedroom each morning, because Moyers wanted to get out of that. Then I'd come back and sit with Moyers along about 9 o'clock and tell him whatever had happened up there. And then at 11 o'clock we'd have a first briefing of the day. We had two, in those days we had two a day. I think Christian had two a day all the time he was there. And we would, Moyers would call the president shortly beforehand and say, this is what we think we're going to get asked and what's your reaction. And then the stenotypist would take it down, the briefing as we held it. And when she went to get and cut a stencil, the flimsy off the stencil was taken to LBJ. He wanted to see it that quick. He didn't want to wait for it to be the first run off the mimeograph machine. And I think that was the source of the belief widely held that he had tapped the press office and could listen to it. I never had an experience where I thought he knew before he got the transcript. But he, I never thought that he had bugged it. In the first place, he would call for the transcript from different places. Sometimes he'd be back in the residence, sometimes he'd be in the Oval Office, sometimes he had another little office next door where he spent considerable time. And if he wasn't in the Oval Office, the transcript was ready. We'd either ask the Secret Service where he was, ask one of his secretaries, or he would call and say, I'm back at the house, and bring that transcript, the briefing over here. And he would mutter about them and complain about hostile questions and so on. Such and such a reporter sure thinks he's a smart ass kid, doesn't he? But he, I think one other thing your question brought to mind. One of the things I said to him very early was that I was impressed, being with him frequently, how much more relaxed he was when he was talking in the East Room to a group of congressmen or visitors or something, and not tied to a podium. And that my suggestion would be that we get him away from that podium. I said, hey, basically, Mr. President, you're a teacher in your skill, and you don't teach as well when you have to be at that podium. For a news conference, he'd have a book with questions, expected questions and answers, and a thumb tab, and he'd been through it. So if he got to ask a question, somebody might say to him, what are we doing about the Burma tin problem? If he, could be that he'd know it, but it also could be that he'd quick flip and take a glance and have to recall his recollection. He would sometimes, but not often, say, I'm sorry, I'm not equipped to respond to that, but I'll get you an answer. But he'd, so we finally agreed to wear a lavalier microphone. And we'd try it. And this was a microphone, and familiar with it, it hangs around your chest. It was bigger than the present one. It was about as big as a cigar butt. It was heavier than that. And it hung on a cord around. With an electric cord going down through his belt in the back. When he got up on the platform, I would grab the loose end of it and plug in the electricity so the microphone was active. And he used it one time, and everybody thought he was just magnificent. He was far more relaxed. I've got pictures of that one where he waved his arms and he gestured and he stalked around. And when it was over, I told him, I said, "That's the best I ever saw you. I hope you'll keep on using that microphone." He said, "Well," he said, "I didn't even notice I had it on." I said, "That's the answer to it, really. If you don't notice you had it on and not worrying, being conscious of it, then you're not anchored to it any more than you were to that podium," which was a big, you used to call it mother. It was a big podium built with microphones built in the side. You didn't see them. And, but the next day, the New York Times carried a page one story about how Johnson's performance at the news conference the day before was mindful of Jack Kennedy's bed. Well, I always felt that he objected to the comparison with Kennedy, but his comment was that you're trying to make me a performer. And I'm not an actor, I'm a president. I won't wear that goddamn microphone again, and he wouldn't. Never did. Another mechanical incident. He went down to San Antonio, or he went down to the ranch one weekend. And Friday morning, Marvin Watson called me and said, "The president wants to make a speech tonight on Vietnam." And I said, "Still where?" He said, I don't know where. "We just sell the networks. He wants to make a speech at 8 o'clock on Vietnam, see if they'll agree to carry it." I said, "Marvin, I got to know where. Is it going to be down, are we going back to Washington?" He said, "No, it's going to be here." I said, "You going to do it in the ranch?" He said, "I don't think so." He said, "Frankly, I got to find a place for him to do it." The president ended up speaking that night at the San Antonio Home Builders Association. It was having its annual dinner dance in a big hall in San Antonio. And it was the only place we could find where he'd get a crowd. Well, Watson had called the real estate office and said, "We could have the president be a speaker at your dinner." And of course they said yes. But when he called me back and told me that, I said, you're going to give me a hell of a problem here. I said, I've been in that building and looked it over and checked it out because I knew sooner or later we'd use it. And it's going to be very hard to light for television. And Marvin laughed and said, "That's your problem." So Watson, it was. So I called Washington and said, "I've got to have enough lights down here to light that room." And the White House signal agency, communications agency. Some found a bunch of lights on a plane, but they all turned out to be on extension poles on easels that rested on the floor. No way you'd get in the balcony of this place. There was no balcony. Get into the ceiling to light adequately. So we had these things standing on 8-foot, 10-foot poles, and we had somebody standing at the bottom of each one to keep it being knocked over. And when the president arrived that night, I said, "Mr. President, you're going to have problems with the lights. They don't work very well because they're too low. But 18 feet's as high as we could get them. Now, if you'll not look beyond the fourth table of the audience." Hi.
Yes. I want to do another thing on the bill we just passed with agriculture. Mm-hmm. And these are some of the subveniences, and this is some Trump police deal. So out of that, we can get something for you.
That's the boss. You do the things he wants to. So I'll wind this up. When he came in, I said, "You can't look beyond the first four rows of tables. You'll be looking at the light and they'll blind you." So when he was through, he hadn't looked up. Frankly, he hadn't looked up at all from the desk. And as he walked, came off the stage, I said, "I hope the lights didn't bother you." He said, "You and your damn machine." He said, "What machine?" I said, "You know, your machine. Well, anytime anything went wrong, it was my network or my newspaper, if these things went fine, the press or the New York Times or my friends at CBS and stuff. So I went to Colonel Albright, who was head of the White House Signal. I keep calling it Signal Corps, they changed the communications agency. I said, did something go wrong with the teleprompter? That's the only machine. He said, no. I said, I'd watch it, worked fine. He said, look what he looked at. Went up and all we could see was just this brass cylinder. And Jack said, I know what happened. I said, what happened? He said, this podium was in storage out at the ranch. And I had two men clean it today. And what they did, they crossed two wires when they as they cleaned it. The machine ran backwards. When the president started to talk, the master control area back behind him kept rolling right, and the guy could keep pace with what the president was saying. But the one in front of him had run backwards. It's like toilet paper running off a roll and emptying. And he looked at this brass. That's why he hadn't looked up, because all he could see was a brass cylinder. And he, months afterwards, he would say to me, how about you and your machine? That picture is a State of the Union message. And the night that he did it, come on over here and look. Here's the teleprompter control back here going around. There's another one here, and there are, hard to read, but on those things, there were two one-way mirrors. So they reflected his reading text, but nobody else on this side could see that it wasn't just, But he had me sit down here with a little mirror to watch this roller of the teleprompter. It was instructed, if anything goes wrong, you fix it that day and fit. Nobody in the world had to fix it. I knew nothing about it. But I was confident enough by then, because he had checked out the machine.